So tonight I want to talk about what in some sense is quite a central question to my own practice, I think sometimes. But I think it's something that we all encounter and all question. And that's what keeps us practicing? How do we, what is it that makes us go, oh, I'm going to start again? Or I'm going to keep going, or oh, I just don't feel like it today, but I'm gonna go and sit anyway, and whatever happens then. Or yesterday was the day I said, oh, I can't sit today, and you don't sit, then you start again. What gets you going the next day? And it's a really important question, I think, because we have to. We struggle. It's like we're human beings and we struggle. And so there's this wonderful chapter in Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. And it's a chapter called Roads to Fulfillment that essentially is answering this question. And so I basically just want to sort of follow through what Joseph says and then go off on various tangents, as I often do. So I'll start by reading something from Joseph here. The Buddha taught about four paths or roads to success, to fulfillment, roads that lead us onward. These are four different qualities of character, each reflecting a different strength of personality. If we can recognize which of them is our particular strength, then we can build on that power we already have, and we can do what has to be done. And it's really interesting that he starts off saying everybody's different. Lots of different ways you could motivate yourself. Well, there's lots of different things that motivate us and different people. And we shouldn't for one second think, well, I have to be like my friend or like everybody else or like it says in that book. It's good to be open to your own strengths and be aware of your own weaknesses, I suppose, too. Sometimes people have the idea that to practice the Dhamma means to live without passion, without fire, that it means a cool and detached passivity. This is a very mistaken notion. Each of the four roads to power involves a tremendous passion, a great fire within us. For those of us in whom that passion stirs, the Dhamma becomes the paramount commitment of our lives. Dharma becomes what's most important. That's how. When I realized I got to that place in my own life, it was like, oh, this is what's more important than pretty much anything else. I mean, perhaps maybe my family, but even there, it's like, well, I can go hang out with my kids, or I can go sit for a week, and I'll go sit for a week. So, it's an interesting equation here. Anyhow, so the first of these four roads. Is something called zeal, sort of an old-fashioned word. I actually looked it up in the dictionary. It's the different definition I came across. I kind of like great energy or enthusiasm. Great energy or enthusiasm in pursuit of a cause or an objective. This is what Joseph has to say. The first road to success that can fuel our commitment is zeal, the strong desire to do, to accomplish something. So this is like, yeah, the reason I practice is I want to do something with my life, something significant somehow. When we feel this quality, we sense that nothing can finally impede us. We feel that we will not be satisfied until we have realized our goal. Sometimes when I think of this quality, I think of the extraordinary enthusiasm and motivation of Olympic athletes or great musicians or anyone who has brought something to perfection. The quality of zeal, of ardency, carries them through their lives. I'm going to do this, I'm going to accomplish this. And they do, based on that strength of mind that unwavering sense of purpose. So a desire to do, a powerful aspiration and motivation, is one of the four roads. So let's look a little more at zeal here. Because zeal, we have to be careful a little bit, because it sort of, in our culture, has some sort of like negative connotations. You know, someone who's overzealous, you know, we say as we look down our nose. You know, and we have to be aware of that, you know, we don't want to be a zealot, right? And zeal, if we're not careful, it leads to this sort of sense of, oh, I've got it, I've got this figured out, those other people, you know. And we're falling into the problem of comparing. And comparing mind is one of the great impediments to practice. You know, I'm better than those other people, I'm so zealous, and look, they're not serious like I am, and blah, 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 blah. So we have to be aware that there's that tendency, and also that, you know, that some people look upon zeal as like overdoing it. What Joseph is saying is, it's not overdoing it, it's like being serious about the practice. There's this really interesting sutta. This is called the Kanki Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's one of those suttas where someone has come and is questioning the Buddha and about basically what keeps us practicing. Trying to answer this question. But what, Master Gautama, is the most helpful for the final arrival at truth? In other words, you know, the Buddha, it's earlier on in the sutta, had talked about that the reason we practice is we're heading towards this final arrival at truth, where we truly understand, not in some intellectual way, but in some sort of clear way. We asked Master Gautama about the thing most helpful for the arrival of final truth. Buddha answers, striving is most helpful for the final arrival at truth. If one does not strive, one does not finally arrive at truth. But because one strives, one does finally arrive at truth. That is why striving is most helpful for the final arrival at truth. So this is where we have to, what I was talking about earlier, about, we have to be careful we don't overstrive. We don't sort of like bear down, I'm going to grit my teeth and I'm going to do this and blah, blah, blah. And you end up being sort of like this grim practitioner. So we have to find balance, you know, be a little gentle with ourselves sometimes. But striving, actually doing something about it. Not just thinking, oh, I'll do something someday, but actually, okay, now I'm going to actually get to work here. So, of course, the guy goes on. He doesn't, one answer isn't enough. But what, Master Gautama, is most helpful for striving? We asked Master Gautama about the things most helpful for striving. Scrutiny is most helpful for striving. If one does not scrutinize, one will not strive. Because one scrutinizes, one strives. That is why scrutiny is most helpful for striving. So I looked up scrutiny in the dictionary too. Like critical observation or examination. And so what the Buddha is getting at here is we have to actually look at the teachings and also look at how we're practicing and going, essentially, is this actually working? Is my mind stiller? Is my mind calmer? Is my life becoming more wholesome? We have to actually look at that stuff and not just assume everything is okay. And we do that because we're putting in all this effort, and then we have to sort of pause and go, yes, but is this okay? This makes sense. Yeah, okay. Sutta goes on. what Master Gotama is most helpful for scrutiny? This guy always has lots of one more level of questions, right? Application of the will is most helpful in scrutiny. If one does not apply one's will, one will not scrutinize. Just because one applies one's will, one scrutinizes. That is why application of the will is most helpful for scrutiny. So here he's talking about that sense of willpower, of I'm going to do this. I apply my will. I have this power of keeping going and actually doing something. And I do that because I need to put that energy into carefully examining what I'm doing and making sure that my striving makes sense. It's all one thing after another, right? But what, Master Gotama, is most helpful for application of will? Zeal is most helpful for the application of will. If one does not arouse zeal, one will not apply one's will. But because one arouses zeal, one applies one's will. That is why zeal is most helpful for the application. So here's this interesting list, and where do we end up with? Zeal. This idea of, you know, great energy and enthusiasm. It's like we not only put in energy, we not only look at what we're doing, we not only apply our willpower, but we also actually have enthusiasm. Wow, this is kind of exciting and really cool. There has to be that sort of enthusiasm in here. I think is we can almost put in the word joy here, or joyful interest might be the right word. It's like, yeah, this is really interesting stuff, you know. And I've certainly felt that many times in my life, in my years of practice, and times I don't. But it's like, you know, you'll come across something, or you hear a Dharma talk, or someone will say something, and you'll go, oh, never thought of it quite that way before. And it gets you kind of excited in a calm, focused way. Not like excited over exuberant, but excited. You have to be like, there has to be enthusiasm. So we have to put in this energy, you know, but we need to make sure that we do it and experience something that brings more happiness into our lives. And then there was one other thing on the list that was called reflective acceptance of the teachings, which gives us zeal. So here are the teachings of the Buddha, this vast, you know, here's a big fat book I'm reading from, right? This vast amount of beautiful teachings that the Buddha did over 40 years that have all been carefully written down and translated, luckily for us. And it's not like we blindly accept these things, but we actually study them and go, yeah, this makes sense. This is what I... He's describing what I want to do. He's describing what, you know, I have, you know, wholesome understanding, right view, and now I have to set the intention to do something. Because these teachings, at some level, just make so much sense to me. That's what creates the zeal. Like, this makes sense, now I gotta do something. So that's the first of these four things. And for some people, this is like, obviously for me, this is a big one. but it's like, everybody finds their way. So this is way number one, right? Yeah, we go on. The second road is the quality of energy. Person who has this resolute determination of heart feels challenged by the thought. This understanding requires great effort. I can do it. Such a person not only remains undaunted by the effort required, but also finds inspiration in the challenge. It is the sense, whatever can be accomplished by effort, that I can do. Some time ago, I read a newspaper article about the death of a legendary racehorse secretariat. Joseph really has a lot of different angles things. The article beautifully eulogized the horse's great, courageous heart, describing how that courage manifested so superbly in all those races. When we act from that place of heart, putting our effort without holding anything back, we develop tremendous strength and power. Deepa Ma, one of my teachers from India, exemplified this quality of heroic effort. There were times in her practice when she was very ill, so weak that she had to crawl up the stairs to the meditation hall to continue her meditation. Nothing daunted her. The last time I saw her before she died, Deepa Ma turned to me and said, "You know, you should sit for 2 days." She didn't mean a 2-day retreat. She meant one sitting, 2 days long. Just sit for 2 days. When she said this, I started to laugh because it seemed so beyond my capacity. She looked at me with deep compassion and said, "Don't be lazy. This is effort." Deepa Ma had an astonishing capacity for effort. It brought her the kind of result that strength of mind brings. People with this power, this characteristic, who have this strength, strong ability to make effort, are not disheartened by how long it takes, how difficult it is. It takes months. It takes years. It doesn't matter. Because the courage of the heart is there. So that's the second of these things, effort. And part of effort, and I came across this in another book. I'm not going to read from the book, but that's just one understanding, is that recognizing what is wholesome and steering away from what, no, excuse me, recognizing what is unwholesome and steering away from it, and recognizing what is wholesome and cultivating it. That's wise effort, defined in one sentence. We see, oh, wait, if I do that, I can see where that goes and don't need to go there. Or, oh, you see something else, oh, that I can see that's really wholesome and I want to go there. That's where we put our effort. Just simple as that. Recognizing what is unwholesome and what is wholesome and steering towards the wholesome as best as we can understand those things, which is, I mean, I'm saying this sort of casually, like, you know, well, everybody knows what wholesome is, right? Well, everybody doesn't, but, and all of us have times when we don't know. But it's a good, simple guidepost. I mean, it's one of those things you know, you could put a little thing on your fridge, you know, like those little things you put on your fridge, like, or in your office on the wall, like, go and do what is wholesome and avoid the unwholesome. Just something simple like that to remind you over and over again that that's what we need to do. There's a couple of related things I wanted to share here. This is a book called Parami by Ajahn Susito. Paramis are the wholesome heart qualities that we can endure. There's a whole teaching on the 10 paramis that I have actually given Dharma talks on in the past. But I just want to point out a couple of the things he says here, which I think are quite interesting. He's talking about how we direct our energy. Regulating and directing energy has to do with establishing boundaries. Boundaries, what a straight out of psychology 101, right, or something. We must consider what is unskillful, what leads to harmful results, and we should let and should be left aside. And we must consider what is skillful, what channels our energies towards what is supportive and nourishing. The most obvious area that we would consider is our ethical standards. Otherwise, we're going to have to deal with the psychological and social mess, the furtiveness and the guilt that comes from not making our ethical boundaries clear. You know, this is, you know, the five precepts that we always talk about at the beginning of every retreat. You know, having, you know, clear ethical lines and saying, not like they're rules, but they're like, here's a way you can decide whether this makes is ethical or not. And using that, those ba using those that understanding to create these boundaries, so that we, they're like the wall, little sort of walls that we sort of set up beside. And they're not big tall walls; they're just little walls. But when we start heading over the edge, we kick the wall. We bump into the wall. Oh, well, I'm going too far that way. Go back into the middle. Following on from that, we can consider what we will attend to and act upon, what our priorities are, and what our area of concern is in any particular situation. We can bear in mind the reflection, this is for my welfare, the welfare of others. Does it lead out of stress and towards peace? Another question we can keep asking ourselves, is this for my welfare and the welfare of others? And does it lead out of stress and towards peace? Instead of setting up a boundary between self and other, this reflection aims for a boundary between intentions and action. Then we can check before we cross that boundary. So we see the intention to arise. I talked about this last week, actually. Intention is the mental formation that arises before we any act of speech or body. So we see an intention to rise, and then we can go, oh, how does this fit in my boundary world? Oh, don't want to follow through with that intention. I've set the boundary, and then I can choose whether to then follow through with an intention or not. And then there's another thing he says here. So, getting to know your true interest. And I thought this was really interesting. Wisdom is an asset for healing and applying energy because it helps you know for yourself where your mind gets caught or spins out. In this respect, wisdom operates by means of mindfulness, the function that bears in mind a particular topic, impulse, mood, or sensation, so that it can be given full attention. With mindfulness, we can zoom in on what's affecting or driving us. Then we can get a more tuned in understanding of ourselves than through the opinions of other people, or even through our own fault-finding attitudes. This is because the aims and programs that you end up adopting aren't necessarily related to your disposition. In society in general, judgment is made based on current ideas of success rather than whether you are following your own aspiration. For instance, maybe at school you didn't get a thrill out of geometry because it wasn't a passionate concern of yours, and so you weren't good at it. So you flunked geometry, and consequently you felt you were a failure. Sometimes you weren't interested in it and weren't very good at it because becomes a problem, and that undercuts your confidence. Along with experiencing the feeling of failing is something you then start to get the sense that perhaps you aren't intelligent or you're just lazy. Because of that, you feel more doubtful about your ability to do anything. Then all kinds of things to compensate for that, often wildly overreaching yourself so that you get stressed. Does your energy come from interest and inspiration, from willingness of heart, or is it caught up trying to climb the wrong mountain? I like that phrase. Are we trying to climb the wrong mountain? So what he's pointing to here is it's really important if we're going to put energy into something, that it's something that we really want to do, that we're not putting a lot of energy into, fitting in to the world, fitting into society, fitting into some ideal that our culture lays out as like how you should be. Because often that's total nonsense. What the culture tells us we should be is like, well, yeah, maybe that might be good, but maybe it's just like not a great idea at all. And we have to sort of be, when we are applying energy, We have to look at that and go, ah, yeah, there's some issues here we want to be aware of. There's one other thing I want to share here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And he's once again talking about this idea of energy. The Pali word for energy is virya, which is often translated as energy. It's also, you see it translated as effort. But then Joseph says that something really interesting here. It is being translated variously as energy, effort, strength, courage, vigor, perseverance, and persistence. These are all translations of the same word by various translators. So, virya, I like the courage, I think, is really interesting, because to really go deep into this practice is actually quite a courageous thing to do. Because you're really going against the current of our society that tells us what we shouldn't do to make ourselves happy. Instead, now I'm going, no, I can do this instead, because this is a courageous act. And also just like perseverance and persistence, which are two words that they indicate, just keep at it, keep at it, keep at it, keep at it. And so I like this sentence. And this Joseph says, each one of these words points to a different facet of the Pali term. In its most basic meaning of energy, virya is the capacity for activity, the power to do something. This energetic capacity, the power to do, manifests in various ways. So once again, there's like these different flavors of effort, I guess you can call them that, for lack of a better term. Different ways we look at it and go, oh, this makes sense. Ah. Back to the original text here. The third road to success is strong love of the Dhamma, the love for the truth that keeps us, our mind, continually absorbed in the practice. This love has great purity of consciousness and is extremely ardent. When you first fall in love, in the ordinary worldly sense, your mind fills with thoughts of your beloved. Love for the Dhamma has that level of intensity. It becomes a path to understanding when it fills our minds. We continue to reflect on the Dhamma, practice it. Nothing else seems equally important. So love of the Dhamma keeps us going. It is our highest love, our highest value. Another way you can look at this. It's like something we feel safe taking refuge in. We take refuge, or we chant the refuge chant. We take refuge in the Dhamma. One of the three qualities we take refuge in. Does the Dhamma make us feel safe? It's an interesting question. Just what I see of the teachings of the Buddha, of the Dhamma in that sense, lighten my heart, make me feel safe despite whatever's going on around me in the world. Because there's lots going on out in the world that makes me feel anything but safe. But does the Dhamma soothe my heart in a sense that allows me to go, but it's going to be okay despite everything? There's another thing. This is another sutta. And just a couple of sentences I want to read. This is a sutta where these three monks are practicing together in the forest, and the Buddha comes to make sure they're doing okay. Then he makes sure that they're eating right and how they're getting along with each other. And one of the monks is then describing how they practice. And basically, it's like they do everything very carefully so they don't have to speak. So they can live very simply and have as much time as possible for the actual formal practice. But then he says, at the very end of this long discussion about all these things they're doing to not have to speak, he says, but every 5 days we sit together discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. They spend time sitting and talking about the Dhamma, because the Dhamma lightens their heart. And it's the only place they put energy and effort. Only in this place is the only time they really speak to each other, is when they're actually talking about what the Buddha's teachings are. This is love for the Dhamma. This is like this idea of it's how important it is, and understanding that we can read the Dhamma, but if we discuss it, sometimes I'll have me be talking to someone. Or I read something in another book that approaches something from a very different way sometimes, and I go, oh, never thought of it quite that way again. And that pause and that like surprise almost of like, oh, I never understood it in that way comes out of discussion. Comes out of being with other people and connecting about the teachings. Whether it's in discussion or in hearing Dharma talks and whatever, but it's like the idea of discussion of the Dhamma is a very powerful tool to test our understanding. Because we understand, and then something happens and we go, huh? I never thought of it that way before. And that sort of wakes us up. You know, because it's pretty easy, if we're not careful, to get into it, like thinking we've got it all figured out. Believe me, you'll never have the Dhamma all figured out. Just forget about that idea completely. It's never going to work. Then there's this other interesting bit of sutta I also wanted to share. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this, I'm just going to read a little bit of this long, long sutta. This is in the section where various Brahmas and Devas have come to question the Buddha. And he's talking about what kept him practicing. Why did he keep practicing? What was it that motivated him to keep going? Let me then honor, respect, and dwell in dependence on the very Dhamma to which I have fully awakened. Now this is like the capital D Dhamma as opposed to the little d Dhamma. Like Dhamma is one of those words, once again, has many translations. In this sense, this Dhamma, often is just translated as, the teachings of the Buddha. But Dhamma also is like the truth, the way, the way things really are. It's a broader sense of things. Then, having known with his own mind the reflection in the Blessed One's mind, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his arm or draw in an extended arm, Brahma Sahampati disappeared from the Brahma world and reappeared before the Blessed One. He arranged his upper robe over one shoulder and raised his joined hands in reverential salutation toward the Blessed One and said to him, "So it is, Blessed One. So it is, Fortunate One. Venerable Sir, those who were the Arhants, the perfected enlightened ones in the past, those Blessed Ones too honored, respected, and dwelt in dependence just on the Dhamma itself. Those who will be Arhants, the perfectly enlightened ones in the future, those Blessed Ones too will honor, respect, and dwell in dependence just on the Dhamma itself." So he's saying that this teaching that the Buddha is expressing in his life through his teaching in his own way is the same truth that other great beings have discovered this truth and in the past and will in the future and express it in their own way. It's like there's this absolute understanding, absolute truth, whatever you want to call it, absolute reality that keeps manifested in the world through different teachers at different times in history. And that's what the Buddha is talking about here when he says he honors the very Dhamma. This is like this absolute truth of the way things are, the nature of existence might be a way to describe it. And that's maybe a deeper idea of love of Dhamma, but it's an interesting one I think that we should keep in mind. And of course, that's number three. Number four, the last of the roads to success is the quality of inquiry or investigation. Some people have a strong interest in understanding the deepest and most profound aspects of the teaching. They are not satisfied to know just the surface things. This kind of mind contemplates the immensity of samsara, the rounds of birth and death, the immensity of the planes of existence, the implications in our lives of the vastness of vision. A person with such fervent inquiry investigates and understands the potential for suffering and the possibilities for freedom. Such a person takes the deepest satisfaction in probing and investigating the profound mysteries of consciousness. So this is someone who's just like totally fascinated by how their mind works. You know, like seeing the more, all the subtleties of it and investigating it and being curious about it. Because from their point of view, the more they understand about how the mind works, the less likely they're going to be thrown off track by the functions of mind. Because the mind is just this neutral thing that just does mind stuff, right? And it's like, it's so easy to get caught up in thinking that what the mind is saying in your head, in that internal dialogue, is, well, my mind says that, it must be true. And it's like, wait a second. If we really look at it, often we can see that what's arising in the mind is total nonsense. But we have to investigate it. We have to be curious. We have to, like, look at that and see that. Okay, and then I have one more bit of Joseph from, this is from Mindfulness again. This is a section called Understanding the Nature of Thought. I think this is like that inquiry that he was talking about. One of the most freeing aspects of investigating the mind comes from examining our thoughts. Mostly we are lost in the movies of our minds and not even aware of the fact that we're thinking. But if we become more mindful of thought as an object of awareness, we can begin to notice what we're thinking. And then on a deeper level, wisdom sees the very ephemeral, impermanent nature of thought itself. So what he's saying here, you know, we're being mindful and we're noting our breath and we're noting physical sensations in the body, and we're noting, you know, emotional tones. But thought in and of itself is a suitable object for meditation. If we're going to be mindful of whatever's arising, well, what's arising is thought. But most often when thought arises, we just let it run and we get caught in it, and or get caught in the emotional content of it. But can we start to see thought as just what's there? Oh, there's a thought. Huh? Yep, there it goes. Nope, there's another thought. And it's all, it doesn't grip us anymore. And so now we can start to see the actual functioning of the mind and the functioning of thought in and of itself. In a couple of my really long, deep retreats, I would be in this space sometimes for small periods of time where I could actually just watch the thoughts arise and not react to them in any way. Just, oh, there's a thought. Isn't that interesting? Oh, there's another one. And just that was all that was going on. And it wasn't like any one particular thought was more important than any other thought. I didn't have to figure it out, didn't have to know what they were, didn't have to pay attention to them even. They could just, that's what was there. Oh, isn't that interesting? Joseph goes on. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche points to the freedom that's possible from this understanding. When a rainbow appears, we see many beautiful colors, yet a rainbow is not something we can clothe ourselves with or wear as an ornament. It simply appears through the conjunction of various conditions. So like, you know, the light's at a certain angle and there's a little bit of moisture in the air and all those sorts of things that make a rainbow appear. Thoughts arise in the mind in just the same way. They have no tangible reality or intrinsic existence at all. There's therefore no logical reason why thoughts should be have so much power over us, nor any reason why we should be enslaved by them. Once you recognize that thoughts are empty, the mind will no longer have the power to deceive us. But as long as we have our deluded thoughts as real, they will continue to torment us mercilessly, as they have been doing throughout countless past lives. Our mind is both our biggest friend, our only friend, often in this practice, and it can also be our biggest problem if we let it run and not find the boundaries for it. And if we and where this practice leads over time is to being able to see the mind actually at work and how it works. But this is like, it takes investigation and curiosity. It's something like, oh, this is really, I want to figure this out. I want to see this. And Joseph continues here. Someone endowed with any one of these four bases of power will undoubtedly come to liberation. Pretty bold statement, right? But it's like, can we see that, you know, some of us tend towards zeal, and some tend towards effort, and some tend towards love of the Dhamma, and some are fascinated by the actual how the mind works, and fascinated by investing. These are four different qualities, four different kinds of qualities of people, and four different ways to motivate ourselves. We may free ourselves through the power of zeal, the great desire and motivation to follow the path. When we do it through the quality of heroic effort, an effort that cannot be stopped, we may come to awakening through our absorption in and love for the Dhamma. Or we may experience freedom through the power of investigation and need to know and understand. Any one of these can be our path of fulfillment. Our work is to recognize where our own strength lies and to practice from that place of strength, to develop it, to cultivate it, and to make it even stronger. Our great life challenge is to do the work of awakening, to see that the path of practice lies in bringing these liberating qualities of heart and mind to each moment. The path of awakening is moment to moment. It is right here. Can we hold this vision and be complete in our attention in this moment? Can we be deeply inspired by what is true, remembering that our practice is never just for oneself? We practice for the benefit and welfare of all beings. The Buddha pointed out the four roads to success. The rest is up to us. And it means this is like what he's pointing to, and what I think is really important is that we think, where do I fit in this picture? What is it that really, you know, keeps me practicing? And it may be that more than one of these Maybe like I'm just not. It's not like oh, I have to pick one and the other three I should ignore. It may be that one is like the primary motivation, and some of these others, are there as well, but it's to some lesser extent. And then we sort of put our main focus on the main one, but keep the others, there. And the other thing is, and I think this is also important, is over time, I think our where we sit with these four changes. As our practice changes, as we change, in my case, as I get older and slower, my ideas about what I want to do change. It's just natural. So it's not like, I pick this one and that's it. We pick, we try and see what makes us, what understand our character, the nature of our character clearly enough that this is the way I should lean. And then at the same time be open to having other things there, and also that we might lean a different way 10 years from now, 20 years from now, not tomorrow. Who knows, right? So it's good to keep that in mind. And of course, I have a little bit of poetry to finish this off. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And it's poem called Setting Forth. Something will be born from this goodbye. In the pain of setting forth, something will die. This is also true. It's like to do this practice, we're giving, it's like this practice is the practice of renunciation. We give up things, we let things go, so we can apply ourselves zealously, with effort, whatever, to the practice. With the release of the old comes a moment when nothing is firmly held, and the unknown burns the bridges of the past. When the smoke clears, my eyes seek out the new horizon. Nothing is known here, but the air is sweet, and breathing deeply I see long dormant seeds send up their shoots from the fertile ground of change. As leaves unfurl to meet the sun, the circle is complete. I will not forget a single step of this sacred journey, nor will I let the comfort lock me in its warm embrace. I do not know what fruit these seeds will bear, but I have faith that what is taking root today will surprise me with its vigor. In birth and death, the in-breath and the final exhalation, there's pain and the movement into truth. I take the step that I am called to, even if I do not know the final destination. That last line is really important. We take the step even though we don't know the final destination. We don't know, I mean, we talk about this is a path of enlightenment, but do we really know what enlightenment is? Do we really know? I don't. I have glimmers of it now and then. I have some vague understanding of it, perhaps. But I keep taking the step towards that final destination. That's all we can do.